stay tuned for The Lynn Show, where I will be describing camouflage, that great trick of the unconscious, and interviewing Alan Arrow, who at 80 has spent most of his life as a lawyer representing people in the music business. Hang on, here come the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive.
The Lynn Show. I realize that for a few weeks now I haven't been saying much about what this show is about. I've just sort of been launching into what it's about. So in case this is the first time you've tuned in, or in case you've been listening for a while and not sure what I'm doing, and with apologies to those of you who have been listening, a small recap. In the first half of these shows, usually what I do is I'm going through my book. The book is called When You Can, You Will, and it's about why we human beings are such creatures of habit and why it's so difficult for us to make the changes that we might want to make at any given time in our lives. At the moment, I am talking about the unconscious. The unconscious, which has gotten such a bad rap in our culture, and which I think is really a gift, a protector, an ally. In the last few shows, I've been talking about the role of the unconscious in our life, how it protects us from changes which our conscious mind thinks we ought to make, and which we're not yet ready to make, and how it does that with a variety of tricks that it has to distract us, and also how it gives us information about ourselves. In this show, I'm going to be talking about the major trick that our unconscious has, and that is the trick of camouflage. In the second half of the show, I've been doing a series of interviews called Anatomy of an Artist, and in this show, I'm interviewing someone who is and has been for most of his 80 years, a support for creative people, specifically people in the music business. That person is Alan Arrow. It's a really interesting interview because it's a different take on what it takes to be an artist in our culture and what it takes to support artists in our culture. In and among that, I play some music and I tell stories from my practice. Oh, practice! Psychotherapist for many, many years. And of course, that's experience is what my book is based on. And if you were listening at the top of the show and you're listening at the end of the show, you'll hear a couple of songs from my own CD. If you want any more information about me, you can get that on my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynne.com. And as I'm having to say these days, if you Google that, there are two hits that come up. And the first one is the old website, which I don't seem to be able to get rid of. And the second one is the new version in which all the podcasts really play. So if you want to hear any of the old shows, there are explanations for what's in all of them, and you can click on there and listen. Well, okay, so now, oh, and in this show, I'm going to play two more songs from a CD by Lillette Jenkins Weisner. I interviewed Lillette 2 weeks ago. If you're curious about that, you should go onto the website and listen. Lillette is an 85-year-old, unbelievable musician, pianist. Been playing since she was three. She could play anything she could hear at three, please, and has studied extensively every kind of music. And her interview was so long that I didn't have an opportunity to really play her music, which is what I do when I play musicians. So I played a cut last week from her classical album, and I'm playing two this week from her jazz album. I'm going to do that right before I interview Alan and right after I interview Alan. And then I'm going to play the interview with Alan. But before I do any of that, I'm going to talk about camouflage and how it protects us. Camouflage is the trick that our unconscious uses to distract us from a danger which our conscious mind does not yet see. If you haven't heard some of the earlier shows, then you haven't heard me talk about the concept of danger. I believe that when we want to make a change, we really want to make it, and sometimes we think our life or at least our happiness depends on it, and we've tried to make it and we have been unable to. I believe that's because there's a danger inherent in the change that we want to make, which our conscious mind does not yet see. If you're interested in my discussion about danger, specifically past dangers, future dangers, the danger of feeling, they all exist in those early podcasts, and they're all identified as such. In those early shows, I talk about the past danger and how that can feel like standing on a diving board having to make a really huge dive into a tiny pool of water. And I talk about the growing edge, which is the place you need to leap off of into when you can't see where you're going or what you might be landing on, and that's what confronts you if you need to make a future danger. I'm going to talk a little bit about that as I talk about camouflage, and so if you haven't heard those early shows, you won't know what I'm talking about, but if you're curious about that, if your interest has been piqued, please do go back up on the website and listen to those early shows. So, your conscious mind is a scientist with a logical, just-the-facts-ma'am approach to life. It urges you on, oblivious to danger. And, of course, it is encouraged by your culture. You live in a kind of, well, I like to call it the Nike culture. Everybody is cheering, just do it, just do it. Don't look at what consequences might there be. Just do it. But your unconscious mind, on the other hand, is a magician. With flashing lights and disappearing tricks and sleight of hand, it creates an obstacle course to distract you until it's safe for you to proceed. your unconscious comes to your rescue. It uses tactics which, as I said earlier, have a bad reputation. It's the master of disguise and distortion, of what you see is not necessarily what you get. It steals your attention away from danger. And the most ingenious technique at its disposal is that of camouflage. You know what camouflage is. That's the trick of making something appear to be something it is not. Your unconscious can shift your attention away from the change you want to make by creating a camouflage problem. Camouflage problems are designed to distract you from danger. With magical misdirection, your unconscious focuses your attention on a problem which is not the problem. So perhaps you're standing on the growing edge facing a future danger, or you're at the tip of the diving board facing a past danger. Your conscious mind and your culture may be yelling, "Go ahead, jump!" But if you're not ready to risk the consequences of the leap, your unconscious may distract you by placing a camouflage problem between you and the chasm. This problem is compelling. You can't ignore it, but you also can't solve it, at least not until it's safe for you to jump. Identifying camouflage problems can really be tricky. When I tell people that the problem they describe may be camouflage, they often get angry. They say, "It can't be camouflage because it's real." But it's not the nature that is real or imagined of the problem that makes it camouflage. It's the ability of this problem to sufficiently distract you from another change, one that you're not yet ready to make. That's what qualifies a problem as camouflage. Your camouflage can literally make anything compelling. In an earlier show, I talked about Joel, who couldn't take his eyes off the tree outside my office window. Your unconscious can choose to use a real problem as your camouflage. It can take something that already concerns you and blow it out of proportion, as when some people are so worried about passing their exams, they can't concentrate on studying. As camouflage, your unconscious can use problems you know you can't solve, but about which you nonetheless worry as if you could solve them. In this category, we find earthquakes and everyone else's problems. Maybe you're guilty of that. That is, you focus so much on the problems of other people in your lives that you don't find the time or the energy or the interest, really, in focusing on your own. Any concern, any issue, any subject that's capable of capturing your attention can be your camouflage problem. Anxiety about work, weight, love, health, or relationships, a desire to have a child, the ability to cook or dress or understand computers, the variations are endless. Anything that gets your attention, anything that seems worth worrying about, can be a camouflage problem. The common thread in all camouflage problems is the capacity of the problem to compel and distract you and your inability to solve it. The important point to remember about camouflage problems is that while they are very real, they are being blown out of proportion by your unconscious, and you cannot solve them because there's something else that if you weren't worrying about this, whatever it is, you would have to deal with and you are not yet ready to. So in the following weeks, I'm going to talk about specific camouflage problems. And you may find that something that you've been spending all your time worrying about and maybe beating yourself up over because you've not been able to solve it is a camouflage problem. And it is my hope that if you discover this, you will be able to take some of the pressure off yourself. Maybe even discover the thing that is not yet ready to be solved. And in the end, to be kinder to yourself. So, I hope that you will stay tuned and listen to the following shows and see if you can identify if you have a camouflage problem. In the meanwhile, we're going to listen to the glorious, spectacular, one-of-a-kind Lilette as she sings, "Hallelujah, I Just Love Him So."
He's my baby and I love him so. In the morning when the sun comes up, he brings my coffee in my favorite cup. Well, that's why I know, hallelujah, I just love him so. When I'm in trouble and I have no friends, I know you'll be with me until the end. Everybody asks me how I'm low, smile and tell him that he told me so. Well, that's why I know, hallelujah, I just love him so. Told my baby on the telephone, baby, that I'm home alone. By the time I come from 1 to 4, find my baby at my door. In the evening when the sun goes down and there is nobody else around, my baby kisses me, holds me tight. Baby, baby, everything's alright. Well, that's why I know, hallelujah, I just love you so.
If you think it is fun listening to Lalette on CD, you should see her in person. She works standing up. This is an 85-year-old woman who is, she can't be 5 feet and she can't weigh 100 pounds. And there is more energy and passion and delight and in that little body. And she just gets the entire room rocking because she's rocking. Anyway, I'm going to play another Lalette tune at the end of the show. But now to the more serious business of supporting the music business. And here, in his capacity to have been doing this for many, 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 many years, is Alan Arrow. Okay, I'm here with Alan Arrow in his conference room at Chukat Arrow.
Hey, Fer. Weber and Herbsman. But we answer the phone Chukat Arrow.
Why?
Because nobody wants to pronounce or spell or remember the rest of the names.
I see. They don't mind.
As you can tell, I got hoarse just saying.
Yes, Alan was saying to me, it is that time of year, by which I understood you to mean that it's allergy season.
Allergy season is right.
Yeah. I had bad hay fever as a kid. Do you know what you're allergic to?
I have no idea. Generally bad debts, but I didn't have any allergies of note when I was a kid, and it's just in my older years that they seem to be upon me in the morning.
So you grew into them, and I grew out of them.
Right.
When I was a kid, I had laryngitis almost all summer long. I used to have a pad. I'd have to write things down.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. But I seem to have grown out of that, because...
Very well.
Yes. Yeah. So I think I explained to you, I'm doing this series of interviews called Anatomy of an Artist, and I've been interviewing artists mostly about how they came to do it, why they did it, and how they managed to pull off. I've been lucky enough to be interviewing people who have had long careers, and that, it seems to me, is an anomaly in this culture, so I've been curious, and they've been talking to me about it. And it occurred to me that I could expand that and talk to the people who are responsible in many ways for artists being able to have careers and prosper. And you are one of those people. You've been doing this a very long time. Am I wrong about that?
Well, I've been practicing law in the entertainment business or entertainment world a very long time. The representation of artists, of famous artists, really started in my life in the 60s. And I had been practicing over 10 years by that time. But suddenly, in the 60s, the advent of rock and roll was upon us. And I had artists such as Mountain and Foreigner and the Rolling Stones and Emerson, Lake and Palmer, Cat Stevens, other less well-known artists, but those who required just as much care and keeping, female songwriter artists, and so on. And it's always been fun. Today, I seem to represent artists who are in their 60s. And part of that, of course, is my age and the lack of relationship or ability to relate to people in their 20s.
Well, this is interesting to me because I'm sitting here looking at you. Alan does not look like a rock and roll lawyer. He's wearing a...
Well, I don't know what a rock and roll lawyer is. I don't
well,
play.
Well, not suit and tie, you know? So I'm wondering, even in the 60s, were those really your kind of people to whom you related really easily? And if so, how did that happen?
Well, one thing leads to another, and I wore suits and ties in the 60s.
I'm sure you did.
I've always felt that people who go to a lawyer want the lawyer to look like and sound like a lawyer.
A lawyer.
They don't necessarily want a good friend or somebody with whom they can drink or drug, and I'm not sure that they want anybody who can dance with them at some event or other or play ball with them. I think they want somebody to represent their interests, counsel with them, and understand what their problems are. And my feeling, not my partners, my partners are dressed down people, and I'm a dress up person.
Wow.
And it's always been that way in my life. My first teacher partner said suit and tie is the order of the day, and that's where I come from.
I'm really curious, did you always want this kind of practice? Did you always want to work with people who are trying to make a living doing creative things?
Well, I like to think so. I certainly wound up in the right place and in the right field. But actually, in my elderly adolescence, I thought I'd be an entertainer.
Stop right here. What kind?
I thought I'd be a singer. I had delusions that I might sound like and be like Frank Sinatra or sometimes Tony Bennett, people like that, and sometimes I thought I could be a stand-up comic.
Did you do any of it?
I did, not on any successful professional basis, but I did a lot of weddings and bar mitzvahs.
You
and
did?
Things like that. Yeah, I did some radio, and I did a little television, and...
Now, this is before you went to law school?
Yes.
This is the elderly adolescence, so we're talking...
Well, yes, I was a collegiate. I started when I was in high school. I even started, actually, when I was 13, and I was on something called the Horn and Arda Children's Hour.
Yes, yes, yes.
Which was on radio. There was no television when I did.
Okay, so now how did that happen?
I had an aunt who wrote a letter to them, and I went up for an audition.
She said, my nephew can sing?
No, she said, my nephew can do imitations of funny people and funny characters. And I did that for a while on their show doing commercials, and then they said, the audience is tired of hearing these commercials.
Oh, dear.
Can you sing? And I said, I don't know. And the next thing I knew, I was singing Less Work for Mother.
Oh, my goodness. You were 13?
Yeah, I was 13.
Now, your aunt sent the letter. How did your parents feel about this?
I don't think they cared one way or the other. The only time they really expressed themselves about it was when I had a choice between going to my confirmation in synagogue and appearing on the Horn and Hardart show on a Sunday morning. I decided to go to the Horn and Hardart show, for which I got lunch money, literally, and the rabbi refused to give me my book and my certificate.
Oh, my goodness.
For which I never forgave him.
Well, it's unforgivable.
Oh, I think it was forgivable. I forsook my religion for showbiz.
I'm telling you, it's the jazz singer all over again.
Not exactly, because I was never as successful as a jazz singer.
Well, but you didn't pursue it either.
No.
So we don't know.
Well, I kind of know.
Okay, so early on, you were captured by the whole idea of performance, of making people laugh or smile or cry or something.
Right.
Right? So it's not so odd, even given the suit, that you gravitated towards other people who had chosen to do that.
Well, it's not odd at all. And then when I was in law school and trying to find my way, I had another uncle, not married to the same aunt, who suggested that I meet a man who called himself a music lawyer. And he said he seems to combine his hobby and his profession. So I met this man, Harold Orenstein, and eventually, when I came out of armed services, I went to work for him.
It's really interesting. I mean, it does seem like your extended family understood you and what you wanted and what turned you on, to use the phrase.
I guess they did better than I did. And the interesting part of it, from my long-range point of view, is that following my entrance into the field, the man who is now my brother-in-law came in to replace me as the inside counsel at a music company and wound up chairman of a large number of music publishing companies. And has just retired from the famous Paramount Music Group. His son is the counsel for the Warner Music Group. His daughter is chief operating officer of MTV. My son is director of copyright and licensing of the Universal Music Group.
Oh, my goodness.
And then I have a son who's a school teacher and a daughter who's at home with us.
So it blossomed in the family.
Oh, it really did.
What did your parents say about your abdication? You said they had a reaction to when you didn't show up or you chose Horn and Hardart.
Oh, they didn't say much about it. My parents were not into directing my life. They seemed to feel that I was single-minded enough to do it on my own, my way.
Wow.
And they just let it happen, pretty much.
Do you have siblings?
Yes, I have a sister.
Younger?
Younger.
So you were the oldest boy?
She's married to the guy who...
Oh, right, of course.
...became chairman of famous Paramount.
Right. So you're the oldest child,
yes.
And you're the son?
The older and the son.
So they were kind of laissez-faire parents with you?
Yeah, pretty much. They were pretty good at raising children. We're both seemingly without drama in our lives, you know, not caused by ourselves anyway. And I think they did a good job.
Clearly. Did they have musical or comedic aspirations, your mother?
No.
So do you know where this comes from in you?
Probably from my mother's family. My father was tone deaf. My mother played pretty good piano, I mean classical piano.
Mm-hmm.
And so did her sisters and her mother. And they were, you know, classicists.
Right.
So,
but there was music there.
Oh, a lot, yes. Yeah.
Do you play?
I twiddle with the piano, but not much. Once when I had hepatitis, when I was in my 40s or 30s, my wife bought me a ukulele and I learned how to play that. And that's gone. My son stole it.
Well, all right. So it makes perfect sense that you were drawn to you know, this as a career. And the interesting piece where it's really your aunt and uncle that do the directing, you know, that point the way in a way. That's kind of interesting to me. I'm always curious about how people wind up where they are.
Well, it's easy to say that that's what I always wanted to do. But if it hadn't been for certainly my uncle saying, meet this fellow Harold, it wouldn't have happened.
No, I think that's right. And that's the point I'm trying to make, is that you can see this in a lot, as I have done these interviews, you can see that there's a moment, there's a point, there's a something, that a door that opens or a window or something that makes it, why are you smiling at me?
I'm smiling because I was thinking of Yogi Berra, when you reach the crossroads, take it.
So I'm always interested in those crossroads that people get. But of course, having said that, once you met Harold, you took it from there.
Oh, yes.
You know, it was clear to you that you were drawn to that. So we don't know. I mean, if it was Bachert, somebody else might have come into your life.
Probably. Somebody would have. Would I have been as successful? Who knows?
Right.
But I seemed to have the ability to relate to people who were creative.
Yes.
Whether they were performers or composers. My favorite client of all time was Frank Lesser.
Oh, my God.
He was a gifted, gifted composer, author.
Please.
Producer, teacher.
I quote Adelaide's Lament over and over to clients.
A poison develops la grippe.
That's right. The line, you can spray her all day with the vitamin A and the bromo fizz, but the medicine never gets anywhere near where the trouble is. This is so true in, you know, psychologically speaking. Well, this is my lecture, you know, on this, but I wind up quoting him over and over again. And that's my favorite play, anyway.
Well, Frank was gifted.
Gifted? My God. So what made Frank Lesser your favorite client?
He was so interesting.
Mm.
He was quite different from any person I've ever met. And very driven to success. And at the same time, beyond the drive and the phenomenal business sense that he had, he was a very tender composer. He was a real romanticist. And if you think about his songs, other than Adelaide's Lament, they're some of the most wonderful love songs that anyone can imagine. Things like Spring Will Be a Little Late this year. Two Sleepy People.
Mm-hmm.
Songs which were almost untranslatable to today's youth.
Mm-hmm.
There is no such thing as Baby, It's Cold Outside. Yes, Baby, It's Cold Outside.
Mm-hmm.
My Heart Is So Full of You.
Yes.
Those lines are just endless to me. And the other night, my wife and I went to see South Pacific.
Mm.
And it's wonderful. But it doesn't have the tenderness.
Yes.
Even songs such as Younger Than Springtime and This Nearly Was Mine are not as great in their message.
Right.
Frank would say in his lyrics, I want to get you in bed.
Right, right, right. Well, that's what Baby, It's Called Outside is all about.
Oh, they
it's
all
wonderful.
Are.
Yeah.
They all are. And there was no masking it. You know, different words, different flavors, different colors, but the message is there. And, you know, he was a sexual person.
Yes.
And it showed in everything he did. Thing about being a lawyer for celebritous people, successful celebritous people, is the knowledge and acting on the knowledge that these are very complicated businesses that we represent. They're not just dolls that you wind up, put on a stage, and they perform. They're sensitive, they get sick, they're late, they're early, they have marriages, they have divorces, they have business problems, they have spending problems, they don't have time or interest to a great extent in discussing the nuts and bolts of their lives other than their professions. And telling no to a celebrity client, saying you shouldn't or can't do that, is something which causes those of us to, those of us who treat them honestly, to lose clients. Because when they want something, for whatever reason, they express it often in terms of their need.
I have to have this.
Yes, and it is a need of a different sort.
Right.
It's a need which feeds the ego. It's a need which feeds the security. It's a need which feeds the competitive nature. This one has a Rolls Royce. That one's got to have a Rolls Royce. A little bigger. Mm-hmm. A little better color.
Silver.
Whatever it is.
Yeah, right.
And that's part of, to me, what makes celebrities, particularly in the music field or literary fields, successful. They have to deal in fantasy. There is no reality, to a large extent, in what they do professionally. Life is a fantasy, and they're able, through their fantasies, to get you right in the heart. Because people like me don't think about what they think of. It just doesn't happen. They are able to say something with meaning that I can't give. And it's wonderful to watch this happen. That person who was sitting opposite me in a chair in my office will on stage or on paper be a totally different animal. And I can't be. Associated with fantasy is something about being a child.
Yes.
Children have fantasies. Adults lose them.
Well, I think you're saying something else. I think you're saying that adults lose access to them, but they don't lose them. And so people who are able to remain in touch with them remind those of us who are no longer in touch with them of that, bring that back. And
well,
that's
adults,
what's so compelling.
Adults have the capacity to enjoy the fantasy, but not to create it. When I watch Liza Minnelli on stage, communicating with an audience, mm-hmm. singing I'll Be Seeing You, everybody is in her voice. That's the aura that she has created that I can't. No matter how much I study, no matter what I do, I can't create that aura. And she does it automatically, seemingly without thinking. It's a gift.
And it's a gift that you treasure, really.
Yes, I do. I'm delighted to be among people who are that gifted. And my job is to enable them to continue to express themselves the way they think they should.
Well, I'll tell you that in the little bit of contact that I have had with you around the issue of the contract, what you communicate is care. I feel cared about. And I know that I'm not, I am in no way an important client to you, but still, that's there.
Well, you are an important client because you're a person of property. The minute you write something with your pencil in between the lines on a sheet of music paper, that's a property. And that property lasts longer than we will. Copyrights and other rights last longer than people. And part of my job is to preserve them for the heirs, the descendants, etc. The Constitution of the United States says that Congress shall enact such legislation as shall be necessary to encourage the rights of authors. And the rights of authors are encouraged by copyright, by trademark, by patent. Those are all works of authorship. And they have to be protected for these people so that they can earn a living from them.
From your mouth.
it's a fact. Mm-hmm. And would a composer write a song without the existence of copyright? I suppose some people would, but then what would they do to put food on the table at home?
that's a problem for a lot of people who write music.
Oh, sure. But at least now, what they have composed, if it's successful, will give them income. We were talking about Frank Lesser before. The estate's income is substantial, and those works are still earning money because they are looked after, not just by me, but by Mrs. Lesser and Frank's children and the organization that exists to perpetuate his memory and the value of his works.
We were talking about this before we started the interview, the dichotomy for artists between wanting to work, wanting to be exposed, and wanting to be paid for it, but wanting to be paid what they want to be paid for it, not wanting to say, I won't do this if I can't get what I want. It's as you say, a really complicated position to be in. And so I was interested when you were talking about saying no. What are the kinds of things that you would say no to?
I would say no if a promoter said, we won't pay your band what the band deserves, or you can't have...
Oh.
Yeah.
So, Alan has been more than generous with his time, and he has 5 minutes. And 5 minutes is a very long time, I have reason to know, as I am trying to fill up an hour every week. So I'm just going to ask you, is there anything, as we've been talking, that it occurs to you that you might like to say about what it's like to represent artists, what it's like to represent celebrities, what it's like to have this life that you've had?
Well, for me, I've had a great life. It's been a fabulous ride through the entertainment industry. It's one of those things that you wish could go on forever, but like life, everything ends. But for those people who want to make their careers creatively in the entertainment field, it's tough. It is really tough, because the number of people who succeed is so small compared to those who try.
Mm-hmm.
I have a shelf at home with about 300 disc recordings of people who have or have had a relative or a friend invest what must be $10 or $20 million represented on that shelf in making recordings of their music, their performances, their comic routines, whatever. And those are records that will never see the light of day, because they're just not there.
Mm-hmm.
I can't tell you why there's a difference between one and the other, between a successful and an unsuccessful work. But there's a difference. And while I can't tell you why, I can generally tell you if it exists. When you hear a hit, you know it. Mm-hmm. Like pornography, you can't define it.
Right.
But
when you see it, you know it.
And it's the same with music. And generally speaking, if it's not there in the first 10 or 15 seconds, it's
right.
Never going to be there.
No.
It's got to get you, bazoom, like an advertising commercial.
Yeah.
You know, these guys who are jingle writers are the kings of va-boom.
Yes, yes.
And if you don't get the va-boom, forget it. It's gone. Today, it's so easy and cheap compared to the way it used to be to make a record.
Yeah.
All kinds of machinery and computers and Pro Tools and garages and garage tapes and little keyboards that turn into massive sounds. But if it's not in the pencil, and if it's not in the vocal tone, perfection is not the point. Creativity is it. And those of us who have it, and I'm not one, should thank their God that they have the gift. And they deserve to have everything out of that gift that the world will give them. To those who don't have it, I just hope they recognize it early enough so that they don't waste their own lives pursuing something which just isn't there for them. It's one thing to stand up in your own living room and sing for the relatives and friends who will never tell you that you're not as good as Frank Sinatra. And it's another thing to stand up on a stage in front of 10,000 screaming fans and sweat your brains out and deliver a message to them which they can understand only from you. It's a tough life, but when you get there, boy, is it worth it.
Wow. Thank you. I just want to say that it's clear to me that anybody you represent is incredibly lucky.
Well, thank you.
No, thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So you can hear from that interview the commitment that Alan brings to his work, his attachment to, passion for the people that he represents. And I wasn't kidding when I said that people he represents are really lucky. And he is lucky to be doing this work, which clearly fits him so extraordinarily well. And speaking of work that fits someone extraordinarily well, I'm going to play another song of Lalette's. I'm going to play Help Me Make It Through the Night. I've been saying about Lalette, you know, that in last week I played, I think Rhapsody in Blue, you know, and, you know, a classical piece. And Lalette can and does do everything. So in this show, I've played a classic jazz tune, Hallelujah, and now I'm going to play a classic country song, Help Me Make It Through the Night. And I just don't have time to play everything that Lalette can do. She also does hymns and religious music. Well, as she says, she doesn't want to be pigeonholed or classified. She is a musician. And so here, without further you-know-what, is Lalette Jenkins-Weisner, and Help Me Make It Through the Night. Lillette. So is that something? If you have heard all of the pieces I've played, you wouldn't necessarily know you were listening to the same artist. But you are the uncategorizable Lillette Jenkins Weisner. If you heard the interview I did with her, she's just remarkable. And if you want to hear her in person, you can call her actually at 941-922-0622 and ask her where she's playing. If you live around or near or in driving distance from Sarasota, she plays around town a lot. But she also is still playing out there in the world. We had to put off doing this interview because Lillette had a gig. I said, well, where is it? She said, well, I'm off this weekend to Virginia, North Carolina. I said, my God, Lillette, you're still on the road? And she said, honey, if my feet hit the floor and my hands hit the keys, I'm all right. And the truth is that if Lillette's hands hit the keys, we're all right. So I encourage you to find a way to hear her play live, which is an experience you will not believe, or at least get one of her CDs, and you can get that either by calling her, and I'll give you her number again, 941-922-0622, or going up on my website, as you can always do, thelinshow.com, and I will put you in touch with her. I will also put you in touch with Josh Hackney, without whom this show absolutely could not happen. Josh, the one who is responsible for everything that goes right in this show. I will take complete responsibility for all the flaws. All the credit goes to Josh. So if you've got issues with recording, computer, electronics, any of that stuff, you really want to get in touch with Josh. And again, you can go up on my website and I will make that possible. Earlier I was talking about people whose life reflects them. In the next 2 weeks, I'm going to do a two-part interview with Keith Fitzgerald. In a way, this is a departure from my Anatomy of an Artist series because Keith is an elected official and a political science teacher teaching on the university level. But when you listen to Keith, you will hear him say, and you will know that it is true, that for Keith, politics is an art form. Being a politician is an artist. And you will hear from Keith what is an unusual and compelling take on what it means to be a good politician. This is in the nature of a mini political science course, and I thought that it was appropriate to air those two, that interview, it's in two pieces because it was so long, in the last 2 weeks in October, as we are, and you all know we are, running up on the election. So I hope that you will be here with me for those 2 weeks. And again, I hope that in this show you have heard something you can use, something that entertained you, something that engaged you, something that made you want to come back and listen again, because I will be here next week, same time, same station, that is 1 o'clock on Tuesday afternoon Eastern Standard Time, or 10 o'clock on the West Coast, and Monday morning, 3 a.m., for those people who might be listening overseas and any of you insomniacs. You know that joke? I always have trouble with this joke. What did the dyslexic insomniac agnostic say? Oh, no. What did the dyslexic insomniac agnostic think? Do. What did it do? It stayed up all night wondering if there was a dog. Okay, think about it. That's my favorite joke, but it took me a long time to get it. All right. Hopefully, you and I will both be here next week. You see,
I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle.
Tune in again next week when I'll be playing the first half of my interview with State Representative Keith Fitzgerald and describing one camouflage problem.
With a bang, life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go. That I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes, every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have got